Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jackie Lighton, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Warm eggs from the chicken, apples from the tree are things you might expect in the country, not the city. My guests today are bridging that gap. They're city slickers with green thumbs, strong stomachs, and grand visions for growing food in cities, for transforming paved, barren lots into fields of plenty and feedlots. This hour on Point, heirloom tomatoes, tilapia, pigs, and worms, we'll talk about farming in the inner city. You can join the conversation. Have you tried growing food in the city? Hauled dirt to your rooftop? Sowed vegetables? Kept hens? You can also comment on our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. And joining me now from Milwaukee, Wisconsin, is Will Allen. He's the founder and CEO of Growing Power, an urban farm based in northwest Milwaukee. He's the recipient of a 2008 MacArthur Foundation Genius Grant, and he was recently profiled in the New York Times Magazine. Will Allen, welcome to On Point.
Hello, Jackie.
Nice to have you here. And joining us from Berkeley, California, is Novella Carpenter. She started Ghost Town Farm on an abandoned lot next to her home in Oakland, California, and she writes about it in her new book, Farm City, The Education of an Urban Farmer, which is a terrific read. So, Novella, thank you for joining us.
Hi, Jackie. Great to be here.
I'd like to ask you both to tell us a little bit about your very, very different types of operations. I'd like to start with you, Will Allen. I have to say I'm born and bred 25 miles away from Milwaukee in Oconomowoc, Wisconsin, and family's all still there, and I had not heard of Growing Power in Milwaukee.
Well, we've been around for about 16 years. I actually purchased the last remaining farm in the city of Milwaukee in 1993. And in 1995, we got incorporated as a nonprofit. So we've been around for quite some time. But along that continuum, we started working with youth and it kind of developed into a multi-generational organization around developing a local food system in the community. And now it's branched out to the point that we have 8 farms, 4 in Illinois and 4 in Wisconsin, and outreach training centers around the country. And we do some work internationally around small-scale growing food inside cities and overcoming some of the challenges and being able to do that, because it's important that we start transforming our the way that we grow food, because more people worldwide are moving into cities and we have to figure out how to grow food closer to where they live. So it's really a pretty practical thing that we're doing.
How did you envision, back when you got started, the nexus of planting and harvesting and doing it in the gritty areas in which you're doing it? How many neighborhood people are aware that you're there and benefit from you, from your operation?
Well, I think the first thing you do, we do it in a very vertical kind of way, and the most important piece that you have to do is to engage the community and organize the community around what you're doing, and what we're doing is growing food. So a lot of times that takes a lot of patience and to get the community to look at you as an asset, because you really can't move forward in doing some of the things that you have to do in terms of growing soil. Because that's what we do. We grow soil to be able to grow this good food. So we spend a lot of time. One of the tools in getting embedded in the community is actually working with the youth in the community. So that's what we did. We were a youth-serving organization at first. And once you get the kids, the adults seem to come on board. So
Give me a little picture, would you? Just a couple of sentences about what Growing Power looks like in Milwaukee.
Well, if you come into our facility, it's a 3-acre facility. We have 6 main A-frame greenhouses that were built in the late 1920s. It's a 19th century farm in an area that used to be a farming area called Granville Township that Milwaukee annexed, I believe, in the 30s or maybe in the 40s. I don't know quite when they did that, but it was a farming area that's now a residential area with this last remaining farm. When you come in, you'll see a number of things. You'll see greenhouses, just stuff with growing from the 25,000 pots that we grow, about 125 different varieties of vegetables, to flats where we grow sprouts that we turn over every week. As you proceed through the greenhouses, you'll see about 110,000 gallons of fish systems that we do aquaponics raising, yellow perch, lake perch that reside in Lake Michigan, but they're mercury contaminated, so there's a moratorium on commercial fishing for that fish, and there are not a lot of numbers in the Great Lakes anymore. We also started out 13 years ago raising tilapia. So we have tilapia and in-ground systems, and we use the vertical space in the greenhouse. We have five layers of growing from in the ground. As you look up toward the ceiling, you'll have five different levels. So we maximize this high-valued space, because in the wintertime, we have to heat that space, and because we grow year-round.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that I always wanted to do, I always wondered why, if we're going to grow good food, we need to grow it year-round. We just can't eat for 25 weeks or whatever. We need to eat for 52 weeks. So that's one of the things that we've been able to do and demonstrate, that you can grow food and make money as a business, year-round.
Okay.
Inside cities, because we've got to do that.
Good. Well, we'll come back to you in just a moment. I'd like, Novella, would you tell us a bit about the wonderful vacant lot that you squatted on to start your farm, and a little bit about what your vision was, and walk us through it.
Sure. I'd just like to say that it is such an honor to be on the show with Will Allen. He's a hero of urban farming. He's just, I can't express that enough. It's just such an honor. But to get to my farm, I'm basically a person that, I'm not the kind of person to start a nonprofit or a business or anything like that, but I moved into my apartment in Oakland, California, and I noticed that there was this vacant lot. Some of Oakland is really beautiful and is doing really well economically. Other parts are not, and this was part of, the neighborhood that was struggling because of a history of many things. But so there was a vacant lot next to my apartment. I was an urban farmer in Seattle, and so I decided that I would sort of take over this lot and start growing my own food. I don't have a lot of money. I can't really afford to buy something or rent something. So that was how that started. I just started growing vegetables, and then I got chickens and bees, and eventually, pigs. But it's a long story.
Well, we'll get to the pigs in a later part of our show. But that was actually what I was thinking of in the straw. Stomach thing, but both of you overcame a pretty skeptical public right around you. Well, actually, Novella, some mm-hmm. people were skeptical, but some of your neighbors have really been great.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the interesting thing, and I'm sure Will experiences this as well, is that many people in my community are either from they're African American people from originally from the South, and their parents were farmers. So I often get advice from my neighbors, people are not critical. They're excited. They're excited to see something growing in a place that's kind of considered a blighted area. In addition to that, there are also many immigrant groups who live in my neighborhood. People from Vietnam, places in the city in Vietnam, and that's sort of something that regularly happens in what we call third world countries, India and Vietnam. There's a major urban farming scene going on there. There always has been. So it's a relatively new thing to the United States, but people in places like Vietnam are way ahead of us in terms of knowing what to grow in cities, how to do it. Gardening and farming in small spaces is kind of what they have been doing. So we can learn a lot from them.
Do you think that we're coming around, Will Allen, as the recession has shaken us, to the notion that we all need to grow our own food somehow, even if it's just a pot of tomatoes?
Yeah, I really do. I looked at this, you know, in the 50s, 60s, you know, when hippies went out and started growing in rural areas, growing organic food, and now we moved in the 70s and 80s. And now that we're in the 2000s, more people have come on board the movement, the good food movement, to now, in the last couple of years, you've just seen just mainstream folks and top-down operators like corporate companies as well as politicos and universities coming into a movement that started from the grassroots. So today we sit here, and I don't even call this a movement anymore. I call it the Good Food Revolution because it really has reached that status when you, as I travel around the country and travel around the world, because it's really a worldwide phenomena. And people are starting to take action. Before it was a lot of talk, but now you're starting to see more and more people get involved. It's becoming a multicultural revolution. The most pleasing thing to me today is that more people of color are joining the revolution, and immigrants who have been persecuted growing good food in their countries, and African-Americans who used to look at this as slaves' work.
Mm-hmm.
10 years ago, I would get that statement from folks in the community, I don't want to do that because that's slaves' work. But now that's changing, and that's one of the most pleasing things for me.
This is On Point. I'm Jackie Lydon, in for Tom Ashbrook. And we're talking this hour about urban farming, growing vegetables, keeping bees in the inner city. Will Allen is with us, and he started the urban farm called Growing Power in Northwest Milwaukee a long time ago, in about 1993. It supplies over 10,000 people a year now. And Novella Carpenter is with us. She's newer to the game. She's the author of Farm City, The Education of an Urban Farmer. It's just come out, and you can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. I'd like to ask you both to hang on just a minute. Will, you were talking about how this is now a good food revolution and politicos are getting into the act. Well, I don't think we could go higher than Michelle Obama. She made a big statement with her White House garden on the South Lawn. It's an 1,100-square-foot plot planted with the help of some local fifth graders. It was planted in March. I got to see it back then. Here's Michelle Obama with those students on Harvest Day come June.
All right, so it's Harvest Day. We've been through the whole process, right?
Yes.
You guys came and helped pull up the soil. Remember how hard that was?
Yeah.
So now, today, is the fun part. We get to pick some stuff, clean it, cook it, and eat it with Sam.
Did you ever think that there would be a vegetable garden on the White House lawn, Will Allen?
No, quite frankly, it was a big surprise that it happened so quickly. I was hoping that there would be a lot more talk during the primaries about food systems and with the candidates really talking about how important food is to our country and how we have to change this terrible industrial food system that we have to a more community-based local food system that over 84% of people recently surveyed really want. So once President Obama was elected and having this happen so quickly, even though it's 1,100 square feet, I myself and some other folks would love to see this be expanded to a 5-acre farm that would really demonstrate the future of what I think is going to be our future farms in America, smaller, more intensively grown, more communal in terms of people participating in the act. But this is a great start because mm-hmm. it's led to, in Milwaukee, Mayor Barrett here, Growing Power just put in a 5 weeks ago, we put in the mayor's garden at City Hall. So we're growing food in Milwaukee, and that was a result of, you know, having the garden at the White House. So and just the movement and his support of what we're doing here in Milwaukee.
And as a Wisconsinite, I got to tell you, you have to work in a window of a lot less time. She's getting a harvest pretty fast. Novella, the other thing that you really point out in your book is this is not for the faint of heart. And how is it that people are as interested as they are? There's a reason that people left the land. You talk in the book about your own parents and their isolation. Mm-hmm. Gardening's hard. Nature's cruel. Things are capricious. You can lose your money.
Yeah, no, it's true. I mean, it's funny what Will was saying about, you know, the back to the land movement of the 70s. I mean, that's what my parents did. They lived in the Bay Area and they moved to Idaho and they decided to live off the land. And it was really rough out there in Idaho with the snow and all those things. And I think that, you know, and also the fact that my parents weren't exactly, you know, they weren't primed for farming, right? You know, if you live in a city and then all of a sudden you're in a rural area trying to farm 100 acres, there's going to be trouble. However, there was trouble for me as well, even on my only 4,500 square foot lot. But, you know, it's part of the educational process, right? A lot of people think, oh, yeah, I'll start urban farming, and they bite off more than they can chew. You know, they get chickens and ducks and turkeys and pigs all at the same time. So for me, I really want to emphasize to people that, you know, the best thing to do is just try to, you know, I think Michelle should get chickens. That's just my opinion. But I think that, you know, you start with something easy. Chickens are really, really easy to raise, and then you get eggs and you get this great compost. And so I think that, you know, if you just take small steps, then it's much gentler on you and your animals. And so, yeah, I think that, but, you know, there's always things that are going to happen. You know, even in the city, there are predators, you know, opossums, raccoons, skunks, rats, those kinds of things. And they want to kill your animals, especially your chickens or your ducks.
As you found, yeah,
as I found, sadly. And so you have to really be careful. You know, you really have to take it seriously. And protect your animals, your babies.
Well, I really want to allow time for you to give us more of your experiences, but we have so many callers who want to get in on this that I think we should listen to what they have to say. And Pete is calling from Charlottesville, Virginia. Hello, Pete.
Hi, Jackie. Thank you for this show. And I find that I'm really envious of your guests, particularly the gentleman in Milwaukee with the greenhouse. That sounds like a really incredible setup there. Over the past couple of years, myself and several other people here locally in the community have started with a small garden. At the Unitarian Church I'm a member of, we asked permission of the church board, and it was granted. Then we ended up planting several raised bed gardens and also put in an in-ground garden. That was last year. And even though we had a late start, we still had a fairly good harvest. And this year, things are going very well. We've gotten a lot of cooperation from other members in the community as well as within the church. And within the past year, I've also started working on a small hydroponic project. And I would just like to know from your guest, what do they think returns of the return on investment, or the return on energy of investment using a hydroponic system, as opposed to an outside traditional farming techniques? Because as a gentleman had mentioned, you know, we have to eat year-round. It's not just when the growing season is working. So I'll just leave those questions for them and take the answers off the air. And again, thank you both very much for your work. I really appreciate it.
So, Will, I know that you have really somehow managed to max out the whole 12 months you've got in Wisconsin. What about what the caller was just talking about?
Well, first of all, I want to thank him for joining the revolution and the fact that many churches have land, especially inside cities, as well as city governments own most of the land. It's churches and the cities. So it's great that he's been able to acquire land. That's important that we get land for long-term use, because one of the issues in terms and one of the challenges in terms of growing food inside cities or even in rural areas or suburban areas is the soil. We have to resurrect the soil. We have to grow new soil. We can't grow in the existing soil. The EPA is starting to step in and look at this phenomena of folks wanting to grow food because the soil is contaminated, and you really can't just till up the existing soil. So we have to grow compost, thousands and thousands of yards of compost.
And how do you do that?
There's lots of waste, thousands and thousands of pounds of waste. We're just scratching the surface. We did 24
waste
million.
Waste from what?
Food waste, pre-cooked food waste. Many wholesalers that bring food in from Salinas Valley into Milwaukee and Chicago and other cities, a lot of it never even reaches the grocery store shelves. It goes bad. So we've been able to pick up 20,000-pound loads at a time from our local wholesalers. I just got a call this morning from Tropic Banana Company here in Milwaukee, and they dumped 184 boxes of bananas yesterday, and they have pineapples and bananas today for us to pick up. So we can take that waste along with the carbon waste of cardboard and leaves and wood chip on the carbon side and grow new soil. So we're going to have to do that.
Do you have to pay for those kinds of boxes of spoiled vegetables and fruits?
No, actually, we get that stuff free. And in doing that, we don't want to really be called a waste hauler. Once you start taking a tipping fee from the folks that are giving it to us, then you get regulated by the DNR and so forth. But as long as you can take that material and have a site that you can do it in a friendly way, because I always look at the back end and not the front end. I'm trying to produce this high nutrient microbiological compost because we're growing everything without chemicals to be able to grow this food. So if you're able to grow healthy soil, you can grow healthy food. It's just like when you talk to folks like Joel Salatin, and he'll tell you in a minute that he's growing grass for grazing. So that's what he does. He grows grass, and therefore he can grow this really healthy healthy steers and healthy hogs in a friendly way. So this, what we're doing is we grow soil. Almost anybody can grow food if they have high nutrient compost. And that's where it's at. To me, that's really where it's at.
And Will, I think I may have cut you off. You were about to tell us how much of that stuff, how much soil you produced from composting annually.
Well, we do. We collect about 24 million pounds, and about half of that actually, once it shrinks down, about half of that becomes compost, and then we take that compost and turn it into vermicompost because we have 5,000 pounds of worms that make this value-added fertilizer called worm castings. So we produce about 100,000 pounds of worm castings every 4 months.
Okay.
And that is what we use to fertilize the plants because, as you know, when you water plants, you're leaching out nutrient and you have to have a replacement nutrient system, and that's what we use, which I consider the best, and many people, the best organic fertilizer there is worm castings.
Okay. Let's take another call. Julie is calling from Boston. Hi there, Julie.
Hi, Jackie. Thanks so much for taking my call. Many thanks also to Novella and Will for bringing their experience to the table here. My question, I guess, is for Novella. I'm very curious to hear of the logistics of squatting on the land, mm-hmm. what the city thought of it or didn't think of it, and how it is that you came to, I guess, be viewed favorably by the city and other neighbors, and how and what advice you could offer someone who would like to do that in the city that they're in, because there's certainly mm-hmm. many vacant lots around me where I live in Roxbury, mm-hmm. and I've done some small-scale guerrilla farming with mm-hmm. many kids on my block one season, and I would like to do something further, and I'll take your advice off the air. Thank you.
Thanks. That's a great question, and people often ask me that. The best thing to do is, I mean, you know, it's not really what I did, which I just started farming because, you know, really, and I don't know if your situation is like this in Boston, but these abandoned lots become repositories for garbage. And so people start dumping mattresses and cars and all kinds of things. And so oftentimes, you know, often what is happening, let's just be real, is the owners are sitting on the lot in the hopes that it's going to increase in value over time. So it's an investment for them. And they're not. They maybe are going to develop in like 5 years or 10 years or whatever their plan is. So in that time, You know, it kind of makes sense for someone to do something with the property. And so I think that's what eventually happened with the person who owned the land. You know, he showed up, saw my farm, you know, took a couple steps back, couldn't believe it. And I actually was home at the time and I went downstairs and talked to him. And he was excited about it. You know, he wasn't, you know, for him, it was nice that there wasn't garbage. It was nice that, you know, I was keeping the weeds down because, you know, most cities will charge a fee. They'll go around and mow the lawns of these vacant lots, whack back the weeds, and then send a bill to the owner of the property. What happens is it gets a little complicated, especially in cities, because people are very they like to sue and think about like liability issues. So one of the things it is really easy to do is just get a simple contract written up that basically you take liability for the lot and anything that happens on it. And, you know, mostly nothing's going to happen. It's just sort of a thing to the property owner wants to have just to cover their bottoms. So that's basically a good idea. It's also great to try to create a community garden. Sometimes the property is it's owned by the city. Somebody didn't pay their back taxes and now it's owned by the city. Those are places where you can actually contact the city and start a community garden. What I've noticed, however, is that it's better to just go ahead and start gardening and sort of offer the, you know, put a little bit of work into it so people can see the possibility. I think it's hard for people to imagine a garden on a vacant lot until it actually exists.
Mm-hmm. And I just want to say you did have to enlist the neighbors a little bit in terms of your pigs, especially when you moved in the pigs and started dumpster diving for fish guts to feed them.
Right.
So at that point, I thought, she's really out there.
Yeah, she's gross. I know, me too. My boyfriend and I turned into monsters, basically. But yeah, when we got pigs, it's funny listening to Will talk about the composting. So it was basically my pigs were an intermediary between that, the food scraps and the compost. So the pigs, one of the parts of living in a city is that you notice all this waste, you know, in dumpsters, at restaurants, table scraps, and all those things. When I was originally thinking about getting the pigs, part of the reason was because I knew I could feed them only from the city waste. And that was that seemed like a really empowering thing, right? That you mm-hmm. didn't have to buy anything to feed these animals and then they would grow up and make delicious pork. The pigs were a lot of work and they actually ate so much food, it just became a major chore for us. But at the same time, they would also escape occasionally. And so they would caper down, you know, Martin Luther King Way, where I live, and the neighbors would help me herd them back. So in a way, it was sort of like, you know, that sounds like kind of awful, but in some ways it was really hilarious. And my neighborhood, I mean, you know, people are really friendly and wonderful, and they would help me herd the animals in, and then we'd have a discussion. You know what I mean? So it's like the animals and the garden, the vegetables. It's kind of like this open. It opens up a conversation that you can have with people because people will share their stories about where they came from and what they grow, or you know, when they raise pigs, or how to kill a pig. You know, so there's all these different things that you can learn from having animals and vegetables around and then interacting with people.
This is On Point. I'm Jackie Leiden, in for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking today about urban farming. Growing tomatoes and kale, keeping tilapia and chickens in the inner city. Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Will Allen is with us from Milwaukee. He's the founder of the Urban Farm Growing Power and the recipient of a 2008 MacArthur Genius Award. And Novella Carpenter is with us from Berkeley, California. She's the author of the terrific new book, Farm City, The Education of an Urban Farmer Who's Farming. And I'd like to go, Will and Novella, to caller Manny is calling from Fort Myers, Florida. Hey there, Manny.
Hi, Jackie. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. And a great big thanks to both of your guests. I'm with a nonprofit called Sown Together, S-O-W-N Together. And Mr. Allen, I wanted to thank you personally for inspiring. In addition to my wife, you inspired us to band together and to create this nonprofit. We're a group that is basically looking at Growing Power as our prototype, so to speak, and as something that we can reproduce here in Lee County. Lee County is one of the counties that's been hardest hit by the housing bust, and the roles of the newly poor, the newly hungry, have just increased exponentially. And what we've done is we've been able to partner with some of the local soup kitchens and food banks, and we've gotten a part of the grant to help as seed money to start this project. We've been able to educate and help start a few really nice vegetable gardens at local a foster care facility, at an inner city group or an inner city complex, sporting and recreational complex, and the response has been great. And I think it's so wonderful what you guys are doing, and the need to help feed and educate hungry people throughout, you know, the county and beyond is just so important. So I'm really thankful for your inspiration, and I just wanted to share that experience with you guys.
Well, thanks for calling in, Manny. And do you think, Will and Novella, that this is a movement that's here to stay?
Yeah, thanks, Manny. Coming from the state of Florida, having gone to University of Miami, so I'm a hurricane. Hope you don't mind that. But at any rate, I've heard from a lot of folks from Florida. As a matter of fact, we have a training center in Davie, Florida, with the North-South Institute, working with them to help train farmers in that region and growers in that region. I think, like I said before, this isn't a movement anymore. It's a revolution. It's not a faddish thing. It's something that's going to be here to stay. We have a lot of challenges, I mentioned before, in terms of, growing new soil. One of the other challenges is securing land. Land banking land so that we can do this, because that's going to be key, because when you have to resurrect a vacant lot, you put a lot of resources into growing soil and getting the community inspired to want to participate in this revolution. So you have to have long-term land tenure, and that's one of the reasons when we incorporated years ago, we became a land trust as well, because we want to make sure we have long-term use of the land, whether we purchase it or we get it deeded to us. And this has to happen all over the country, because to fundamentally change this bad food system, this industrial food system, we need in this country about 50 million new people growing food in the side yards, backyards, vacant lots, on their porches and containers. I even heard young people talking about, why couldn't we grow on part of the fire escape or wherever inside vacant buildings to be able to grow fish in aquaponic systems. But we have to really expand some of the smaller gardens. Most of the movement in this has been around youth gardens around the country. So we need to expand into more commercial-type ventures, because I believe that we can grow many, many jobs in this new food system that's growing.
Novella, so, were you able to keep your vacant lot?
Yeah, I was. I mean, that's part of the genius of the recession for an urban farmer, squatter, is that, you know, and these are what Will was saying is totally true, right? We have to secure land. I mean, that's kind of what I'm after now that land prices are much lower in Oakland, buying contiguous lots and setting up a demonstration urban farm. And I think that if every city, major city, had an urban farm, like a demonstration area where people could go and learn how to raise different vegetables and livestock in a way that's appropriate for their climate and for their city location, and sort of get tips trips for foraging for inputs and those kinds of things, that would be huge. I mean, it could be like a center, a place where everybody comes to learn, maybe cans communally, you know, puts up your harvest together, learns pickling, those kinds of things.
Okay.
And I think that that is something that to bear in mind, though, that part of urban farming, the history in the United States at least, is that it was done during sort of hard economic times. You know, in 1893, there were these potato patches in Detroit, and then there were all these community gardens that started. But when the Depression ended, then people were just like, oh, cool, I can just go back to buying food at the supermarket. And so, you know, in order for this to last, I think it's true, we have to have young people, and we do have to make it economically viable, some kind of that, you know, that there are jobs available, that you can sell things. I was really inspired. I went to New York, and I saw a rooftop garden there, 6,000 square foot rooftop garden, right in the middle of Brooklyn. It was beautiful, and the young man who is farming there is selling to restaurants. So there is a synergy. You know, cities do need food, and so it does make sense to grow, especially the most perishable things that don't, you know, transport well across country.
Right. Let's take another call. Ray is calling from Champaign, Illinois. Hello, Ray.
Hi, Jackie. Thank you so much for taking my call. I'm actually calling on behalf of a really good friend of mine, Aaron Ammons, who's very much into urban farming, got a youth program together where he's doing a lot of this. But the reticence of the community, I think, is slowing him down. I mean, me included, because he tried to get me involved a lot. And I'm, you know, we are busy with our own things, and so we don't really see how critical it is. That's why I really appreciate you having the guests that you have on the show, because what's needed in many of these urban areas is a movement. We live in a predominantly African-American area. Many of these people have a long history of farming, but there's a big reticence because of slavery and being forced to farm for free and then being forced into sharecropping for debt. But the experience is there. In addition, there's a lot of land. There's a lot of empty lots. So the space is there. And then in addition, they're not the kinds of grocery stores that you find in many of the better areas. They're not located in these predominantly black areas. And so the need is there. So it's a perfect space. But trying to get people involved, especially African-Americans who have that kind of history, you know, that's a big obstacle. And I want to know if your guests, you know, have any experience trying to motivate communities like this that have the experience somewhere in their background, have the space. It's already apparent that there's a need,
okay,
but trying to get a movement started is where I think we would need some help. And any consulting that might be available.
Thank you for that, Ray. You know, Will, this reminded me of I used to cover ag, believe it or not, for NPR, and once did a story on African-American truck farmers in Arkansas who were putting their kids through college from these little truck farms. But there is, as he said, and you had mentioned earlier, the stigma, and that's a psychological hurdle.
Right. And I can go back to my own history of my father being a sharecropper in the 30s and moving to the Washington, D.C. area. And unlike many African-American males that suffered under being sharecropper, he wanted myself and my brothers to learn about how to grow food. And we had a small farm, so I learned how to do it at a very early age. But as we move forward, I think what Novella said is very key in terms of having a demonstration in almost every city, a place that people can come to and get inspired and learn how to do this. And that's what we do at Growing Power. We have all these national, international trainings throughout the year. In a hands-on way to teach people how to do it. But the first thing I said earlier in the conversation today was that the first thing you have to do in this vertical process is to get people on board, to really organize people around the food system, because as this caller said, there are a lot of skeptics out there, a lot of people of color and former farm workers, Latino farm workers, African-American farm workers, Asian folks that have lost their land in their countries, that we have to inspire. So I think the thing that we do best at Growing Power, even though we do all these trainings and have this demonstration, is inspire people to want to go into action.
Well, like one would think that some of the problems in the food chain would also give credence to your argument that the problems you're seeing in spinach and peanuts, the rise of obesity and diabetes has got to be helping further this along. I want to take another call, though, because I'd like you to respond to it. Ellen is calling from Worcester, Mass. Hello there, Ellen.
Hi, Jackie. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. What's your question, please?
Well, it's really more of a comment. If you go back in history, if you look in the early 1800s, it was very common for people to keep pigs and chickens in their city areas, even in the slum areas in New York. And there was really quite problematic. I mean, the problem with feces, the problem with diseases, and the fact that some of these farm animals are, they're not like what, you know, the cartoons with sweet little pigs running around. Pigs grow up to 400 or 500 pounds, and they will attack and bite. And there were horrible stories of pigs giving loose in the city and mauling a child.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Ellen. So, well, what about the marriage, if you will, of livestock and what we need from a city, you know, sidewalks, commerce, traffic movement?
I would say we have goats. We have 35 goats. We have 300 chickens. We have 200 Muscovy ducks. We have turkeys in the city. It's really about managing your livestock in a different kind of way. And one of the important things of having livestock inside the city is because many school systems, for example, don't have the resources anymore to take the kids out to farms in the rural areas. So having these livestock offers those young people a chance to really learn about the animals and where their food comes from and how animals are taken care of in a very natural way. We haven't had any problems. I mean, we've had some issues where a goat might get away and, like Novella said, and be marching down Silver Spring Drive and the neighbors bring him back or they call us. But that's all part of engaging the community and the community wanting to have this farm in the
community city. Herders.
Yeah. So, but from one of the things I wanted to, because a gentleman asked earlier about the economics of growing food closer to where you live and just the environmental impact of growing food inside cities. It's such an important piece because inside most cities we're growing less than 1% of food that is being consumed by people. If we're able to go to 10% of local food, just think about the environmental impact, the financial impact, the job creation that would happen if 10% of our food, imagine 10% less trucks coming from Salinas Valley into Milwaukee and Chicago and New York and so forth. So I think we really have to look at this in terms of a future of because this is not only happening here, but it's happening all over the world.
Let's sneak in one more call. Linda is calling from New Britain, Connecticut. Hello, Linda. What's your question?
Hi. Thank you so much for taking our call. I'm calling on behalf of an urban organic farm in a gritty town in central Connecticut that just celebrated its 10th anniversary. And it started because of an EPA New England brownfields assessment, and it took over greenhouses and an old gas station, an auto repair shop, and now it's 10 years later, 50% is wholesale, 50% is retail, and we are struggling and in debt because of high energy costs. We're trying to look into solar for the greenhouses, which do operate all year. And we need money for a lot of other things. And it takes WIC, coupons. We just were certified for food stamps. But we're asking now the next generation, 10 years later, it's this great urban organic farm that's done exactly what Will has said. We're in awe of Will. How do we take it to the next level? Because we can't keep getting in debt more and more.
Thank you, Linda. So, Will, and you want to answer that in about a minute? I mean, you have tried to testify to Congress about, you asked for $63 million from the stimulus package, but it wasn't considered as infrastructure, to try to take your model to other cities.
Yeah, we're actually working in cities all over the country, but to answer that question, that's why I go back to growing soil in really high nutrient soil. We're growing at $5 a square feet. There's 43,000 square feet in an acre. If you're able to grow at $5 a square foot in an annual year, you'll gross over $200,000 per acre. Now, if you grow, say, sprouts, which we are delivering to the Milwaukee Public School System, and you're able to grow sprouts at, we turn over a tray of sprouts every week. So even if you say you're going to do 40 weeks of sprouts at $30 a square foot is what it comes to, then you're at like $1.2 million per acre. So the economics work. Part of this developing this system is renewable energy to be able to grow food year-round is very important, the piece. And that's why we are working on a high solid anaerobic digester to take food waste into acetic acid to produce methane that scrub to generate electricity.
So like all farmers, Will, what you're saying is that you have to study the cost-benefit when it comes to your resources and what you're going to spend and what you're going to harvest. I wish we could keep going. You're saying yes?
Yes, absolutely. Okay. We have to have a solid business okay. plan to make this work.
All right. Well, I wish we could keep going, but we can't. Thank you so much, both of you. Novella Carpenter is an urban farmer in Oakland with a new book, Farm City, The Education of an Urban Farmer, and Will Allen is the founder and CEO of Growing Power in Milwaukee. I'm Jackie Leiden, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. We think there is a soul. We don't know.